Welcome back to the program. When disaster strikes and loss happens, both human loss and economic loss, people look to be both assured first and then compensated. The assurance is often the job of government, of social institutions, of friends and neighbors, and of family. But when people look to be compensated for a disaster, the process is often a lot more complicated. Who pays? What's the loss worth? And how does emotion enter into the economic algorithm? No one understands this better than our guest today, Kenneth Feinberg. He's one of our nation's leading lawyers and has been front and center in some of the most complex legal disputes in the past 40 years. He served as the special master of the Federal 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund. He was administrator of the BP Gulf Coast Claims Facility. He was the PAYSAR for the 25 highest compensated senior executives under the Federal TARP program and administered the fund for the victims of the Virginia Tech shooting. It is my pleasure to welcome Kenneth Feinberg here to talk about his new book, Who Gets What? Fair Compensation After Tragedy and Financial Upheaval. Kenneth Feinberg, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
Delighted to have you here. First of all, how did you get involved in this kind of work? It goes back to, you talk in the book about the Agent Orange situation was one of the earliest things you were involved in.
That's correct. Back in 1984, the federal judge in Brooklyn, New York, who was responsible for the Agent Orange Vietnam veterans litigation, asked me, I knew the judge, and he asked me to come in and try and resolve the dispute without a trial and then to design the compensation program for the Vietnam veterans. Once I did that successfully, these other tragedies and compensation programs seemed to be directed towards me.
In many ways, part of what you have done and part of this process takes lawyers in general out of the process. I would imagine that lawyers who might have had a lot of employment as a result of all of this may or may not be very happy about how this process works.
Now, that's one of the ironies of this, you see. These programs that I design and administer are alternatives to the conventional legal system where you hire a lawyer, go to court, plead your case before judge and jury, and try and receive compensation. Instead, these programs, policymakers set them up rarely, but when they do get set up, they are alternatives to lawyers, litigation, and trial by battle.
Is there a danger that we set these things up sometimes and not others? For example, and we'll get to the specifics of this a little later on, but the BP oil spill gets this kind of situation. Hurricane Katrina, for example, does not. How do we decide?
That's right. It's a real conundrum. It's a problem. Bad things, Jeff, happen to good people every day in this country, and you don't have a BP oil spill fund or a 9/11 victim compensation fund. Every once in a while, not too often, policymakers decide on their own, Congress, judges, the White House. The tragedy is so unique, it is so unprecedented, we need a better, different way of compensating. And that's when these special programs get triggered and I'm asked to get involved.
And yet, deciding which of these things rises to that level is in and of itself a complicated process.
I mean,
Oklahoma City, for example, didn't have a situation like this.
Nor did Katrina.
Right.
But that's where our policymakers decide. Look, Oklahoma City, a terrible tragedy. We don't need a special compensation fund. Katrina, 1,000 died in the flood. It's a natural disaster. We don't need a special compensation fund. BP oil, a unique environmental catastrophe. 9/11, a terrorist attack from foreign terrorists. We do need, from the country's perspective, we need to help these victims with a special program.
And of course, 9/11 came with its own special problems. It was something that was put in place really without necessarily putting all the pieces and details in place within 9 days after the tragedy, and it really fell upon you and your staff to figure it out.
That's right. Congress, very emotional, said within days after the 9/11 attacks, we want to help these people. We want to show the world our resolve as one nation to stick together, one community, we will demonstrate to the world our generosity. And so they basically in one day deliberated and enacted an unprecedented fund funded completely by the taxpayers, not the airlines, not the World Trade Center, the taxpayers. And this program evolved to me, chosen by the president and the attorney general. You design the program. We just want to make sure it's set up quickly and compensates the victims.
And there was really no amount set. It was kind of open-ended, yes?
No appropriation. Ken, whatever it costs, take it out of petty cash from the U.S. Treasury. Just get these people paid on the airplanes, the World Trade Center, the Pentagon. Get the families of the victims, get the physically injured compensated very generously so they won't litigate. If they take this money, they have to waive their right to sue the airlines or sue the World Trade Center for negligence, and instead, very generous payments from the taxpayer.
Of course, what entered into the equation was that there wasn't one amount, one size fits all, that every bit of compensation was different, and that created its own set of issues.
That's right. If you're trying to attract people out of the litigation system, don't sue. Well, you've got to pay the widows, the family of the stockbroker or the bond trader or the banker at the World Trade Center more than you have to pay the widow of the fireman, the cop, the soldier, the busboy, the waiter. Your system is tied to the traditional litigation system in the sense that you've got to voluntarily get people not to sue. Well, everybody's going to get a different amount of money if they're not going to sue.
Right, and that wasn't that unusual in that these kind of cases go through the courts all the time. People, judges and juries, make these determinations all the time.
That's right. In Texas, every day, in every state, in every city, in every village and hamlet, every town, judges and juries say, the stockbroker who's hit by an automobile or falls off a ladder is worth more than the waiter or the busboy who suffers the same fate. That's the American legal system. It's been that way since the founding of the Republic.
How much more complicated was it, though, to try and tease all of this out within the context of a disaster of the magnitude of 9/11 and the emotional overlay to that?
It's tremendously complicated. First of all, you raise two issues. One, it's one thing when a judge and jury has one case and they're solving what is this life worth? One case, one lawsuit, one individual victim. I was dealing in 9/11 and BP and Virginia Tech with thousands of victims, or hundreds certainly in Virginia Tech, but thousands in 9/11 and BP. In BP, I received over 1 million claims from 50 states and 35 foreign countries. Secondly, the minute you start to give out money, it's human nature, Jeff. Everybody counts other people's money. So it's not only what am I getting from Feinberg. What did he pay my next-door neighbor? Why is he denigrating the memory of my lost loved one or my claim? Why did you give more to my next-door neighbor? What do you have against me or my dead wife or my dead brother-in-law? I mean, that's inevitable when you have very public, transparent compensation programs.
Was there a formula that evolved in this process?
Sure. The same formula that judges and juries use every day. What would the victim have earned but for the tragedy? In 9/11, the victim was 38 years old, and he was a busboy. What does a busboy earn? How long do they work? When do they retire? When do they move on? What did the busboy's lifetime earnings look like? And we ought to add some amount, as we do in the courtroom, for pain and suffering and emotional distress, and basically that's the formula.
Of course, every one of those situations is different also. There's the waiter who also is an actor who is,
right.
You know, would have been a big movie star, but if.
And just ask his family and they'll tell you.
Right.
Mr. Feinberg, when you calculate the damages, the compensation, for the dead busboy. Don't you just use busboy wages because our busboy was going to be a movie star. He was going to go to Hollywood in 10 years and become a Hollywood legend. So make sure you add into your equation, your formula, in his case, what he would have earned not only as a busboy, but as a Hollywood mogul as well.
In the case of 9/11, you developed personal relationships with many of these people. Many of them wanted to talk to you personally. Talk about that.
I decided that it was very important as an emotional matter to give every family who lost a loved one or every injured victim an opportunity, if they wanted, to come and see me personally and to talk with me about their lost loved one. I conducted about 900 individual hearings, and very few people came to me to talk about money. Almost all of them wanted to discuss the memory, to validate the memory of a lost loved one. They came with videos and audio tapes and diplomas and medals and ribbons and things like that.
How did that impact you?
Well, it can't help but impact you. Tragedy after tragedy after tragedy. My daughter would have been a star. My son would have been a hero. My husband, my wife, my granddaughter, my grandson. Unless you have a heart of stone, it can't help but may have an emotional impact. And believe me, I suffered during the life of the 9/11 Fund and the BP Oil Spill Fund, with tale after tale after tale of woe and tragedy and horror.
Did those personal meetings, in some cases, with respect to 9/11, have an impact on you and on the amount of money some of these people were compensated?
Well, you know, you try and do this in a very objective, professional way. You can't run a program where, depending on the tears and the sobs, more money for you and less money for you. I mean, you really got to try and be as objective as you can. But frankly, you know, you hear these stories, I'm sure that they had an impact. I try not to have an impact on the amount of money. But I must say, some of these stories were absolutely horrible and tragic.
And yet, at the end of the day, 98% of the victims and families signed off on these deals.
That's right. If statistics are a fair indication of success, I think the 9/11 Fund and the BP Oil Spill Fund were both highly successful. In 9/11, 98% of all the eligible families who lost a loved one opted voluntarily to take the money rather than litigate. And in BP, in 18 months, before the first trial in BP was even scheduled to begin, we distributed $6.5 billion to about 225,000 people and businesses.
One of the things that was different, certainly, with respect to BP was the degree to which, like so many other things in our country today, it became politicized, that there was the tragedy itself, and then there was the public policy side of it and all the people that jumped on it.
Well, that goes with the territory. You know that. I mean, you're right. In 9/11, there was very little of that because it was a very patriotic, noble initiative from Congress to help the victims. In BP, it's easy for local elected officials to sort of jump on the bandwagon, pay them. Well, you know, I'm not going to pay a dentist. I'm not going to pay a veterinarian or a chiropractor. Why not? They suffered as a result of the spill. And pay everybody. Well, these people didn't submit any documentation. They say they lost money in the Gulf, but they do things with a handshake. So what? Pay them. That's the local culture. Well, you can't do that. I required some proof, some corroborating documentation. A handshake wasn't good enough. One fisherman had documentation, and I told him he was going to get a 1099 from the IRS, and the minute he heard that, he withdrew his claim for $100,000, saying he didn't want a 1099.
Then, of course, there were claims that came from, as you mentioned before, very, very far away, including, you know, the restaurant in New York that couldn't serve Gulf shrimp.
Oh, I received, I think, something like 400 claims from Massachusetts, 200 from New York, 35 foreign countries. The minute BP announced $20 billion, come one, come all, I received in 18 months over 1 million claims. And just amazing how people said, what the heck? There's money to be had. Let's send in a claim and maybe we'll get money.
One of the things that you did early on, which arguably maybe you came to regret, is promise that these claims would be settled really quickly.
Big mistake on my part. I inflated expectation. You got to be careful here with people who are very emotionally distraught by a tragedy. I initially thought that we'd be able to pay claims within a couple of days. But when the claims started to come in volume, most of which lacked necessary documentation, it became apparent that I wasn't going to be able to pay the claims that quickly. Compared to the litigation system, we'll pay them very quickly, but it would take a little bit more time. Well, I rue the day that I ever said, you know, 24 hours or 1 week, because that came back to haunt me and to undercut the credibility of the program.
Why did you say that? Why did you think it could be done that quickly?
Well, because I thought that this was an emergency, that people would immediately send in their claim forms with the type of immediate, like, basic documentation that would allow us to process the claims. And frankly, I got caught up in my own rhetoric. I figured, look, this program is unique. It's an alternative to the litigation system. Let's get the money up and let's get the money out. And then when the claims started to come in, written in crayon, some of them, it became apparent to me that, uh-oh, I overplayed my hand on this. Now, in 90 days, the first 90 days of the program, we distributed $2.5 billion. But it took 90 days to get people to believe that the program was on the up and up and that it was a self-inflicted wound, as I say in my book.
Mm-hmm. Talk about BP and how they behaved in this.
Oh, I think BP deserves a great deal mm-hmm. of credit. Exxon Valdez, as you know, they're still litigating over 20
right.
years later. From the Exxon Valdez spill, they're still in the courtroom fighting. BP decided, to its credit, nope, we don't want to litigate. We don't want to have this drag out in the courts. For a lot of business reasons, let's just pay the claims and move on, and that's what they did.
Talk about the legal community in the Gulf and whether or not there was a lot of pressure on some of the legitimate victims from the spill to litigate, because that might have been more advantageous for the local legal community.
I think that's true. You can't blame the lawyers. The lawyers believe that the way you vindicate rights in this country is in the courtroom. It's the time-honored way. It's the method. It's the preferred method. I don't fault the lawyers for advising their clients, be careful here. Be careful of this program. Aren't you better off litigating with us in a more conventional setting? We'll do right by you. So a great many lawyers, and most, not all, but most of the legal community was opposed to the BP alternative.
And how did you deal with that? How were you able to work around that?
I just said to people, that's your choice. You want to litigate? Go litigate. But if you want generous compensation now, with or without a lawyer, file your claim. You'll have to waive your right to sue eventually. But I'll give you money now. The Gulf Coast Claims Facility will write you a check. And as I say, 225,000 people in 18 months took the check and waived their right to sue.
Talk about looking back at it, what you would have changed about that process,
well,
besides the time frame, right?
Well, I certainly wouldn't have said 24 hours or 1 week to get
right.
the claim paid. That was a mistake. I'd change that. Other than that, as I say in the book, I probably should have set up a new infrastructure for processing the claims in the Gulf. Instead, I used the same vendors that BP had used earlier in processing claims before I arrived, and I think that was sort of a mistake. But other than the mechanical mistake, the big point I make in the book, all of these claims programs, 9/11, BP, Agent Orange, Virginia Tech, all of these programs are aberrations. Their very success, I believe, ironically, their very success should not be a precedent for doing it too often. I think that would be a mistake.
How do you decide when an incident rises to that level?
Well, that's a great question, and my answer is to beg the question by saying that's a question you ask our elected officials, our policymakers. If President Obama believes that we need a very special $20 billion fund from BP, so be it. That's his judgment call. If Congress believes there ought to be a 9/11 victim compensation fund, that's the call. If a judge in Brooklyn decides there ought to be a special compensation program for Vietnam veterans, that's the court's call. That's a decision for others to make. I get involved when that decision's been made, and now somebody has to design and administer the program.
But is there a linkage between the way in which the decision is made, the way in which it's set up, and ultimately the success or failure of how the program is administered?
I think there is. I think the reason these programs are successful, and I believe they have been successful, is because they enjoy the political support, bipartisan political support, of the American people, as witnessed by the decision to create them in the first place. So, whereas these programs, I think, are doomed to fail if they don't have widespread red state, blue state, Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, bipartisan support when they're created, I think that is that insulates these programs from failure and drives, I think, a successful resolution.
All of which made the TARP executive compensation job as your special master for the Treasury Department even more complicated within framework.
But you see, TARP was populist. I mean, the TARP compensation program, that was populist revenge, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
Congress concluded, look, bipartisan, if we're going to bail out these Wall Street companies, if we're going to save them from financial ruin, there's going to be a price to pay. Let's let the Treasury Department set the pay of these high-level executives, and the Secretary of the Treasury asked me to do it, so I did it. But I enjoyed the bipartisan support of the Congress, and what I did was largely non-controversial because Congress said, do it, so I did it.
One of the things you talk a lot about in the book is the way many of these executives really tied their own personal value, their ego, their self-worth to their compensation, that there was this very, very direct linkage. Talk a little bit, not so much about that, but how your prior experience, particularly with respect to 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund and understanding how people value worth and how families value worth, how that drove and in some ways impacted your decisions with respect to TARP.
It's a fabulous question. It could occupy hours of our discussion. The fact of the matter is these programs are driven more by anything, by human nature. You've got to try, and in doing what I do, you've got to try and get inside the head of those who are being compensated. And I learned that in 9/11, and I learned it in spades in the Pazar Wall Street compensation program, where I found out that these corporate executives, that they want to be compensated not because they want another car in the driveway or another summer home or they want to send their kids to private school. They want to be compensated because that money is a barometer of self-worth. Mr. Feinberg, I'm entitled to this money, and if you don't give me what I'm entitled to, you are denigrating my success. You're denigrating my own sense of integrity and self-worth. And when you get into that discussion, you see, Jeff, that becomes very, very emotional. It's not merely how much do I need to earn a good living. It's rather how much am I entitled to as evidence of my personal self-evaluation of life. And that becomes very emotional.
What did that teach you that you didn't already know about Wall Street, about the financial industry, and what makes it tick?
They are in their own little world. The gap between Wall Street thinking and Main Street thinking is not a gap. It's a chasm. And if people really want to understand how Wall Street thinks about pay, they better have a better understanding of how Wall Street thinks generally about themselves and about what they do, because otherwise you're on different planets when it comes to trying to figure out how much is a corporate executive worth.
In looking back on all of this, which was the most difficult of all of these assignments?
9/11. Traumatic death of over 3,000 people. And a program established, as you point out, within days after 9/11. And expecting people in grief, when you knock on their door and you tell them you're there with a check, and they say to you, Mr. Feinberg, are you kidding me? They haven't even returned my husband's body. There isn't even a body to return, and you're here to talk about money? How dare you? And I don't think I will ever confront a more emotional, traumatic challenge than dealing with those families in the thousands that lost loved ones on 9/11.
Kenneth Feinberg, the book is Who Gets What? Fair Compensation After Tragedy and Financial Upheaval. Ken, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
And I thank you, Jeff, for having me on the show.
Thank you.